Welcome to another episode of This Fucking Guy, the show where we spotlight one fucking guy making America worse and explain why they suck. I'm Erin Ryan, host of Crooked Media's Hysteria podcast.
And I'm Alyssa Mastromonaco, the other host of Crooked Media's Hysteria podcast.
Alyssa, have you ever wondered what would happen if a haunted doll were put in charge of the Middle Eastern peace process?
No, I can't say that I have.
Well, wonder no more.
I literally haven't been wondering.
Well, the answer is this episode's subject, Jared Kushner.
Okay.
In order to get the full Jared, we need to go back a bit further in his family history than we normally do with fucking guys, to two Jewish kids living in Eastern Poland during World War II, named Yosel Berkowitz and Ray Kushner.
Eastern Poland was a bad place to be during World War II for pretty much everybody, but especially for Jewish people.
Ray Kushner and her family escaped the Nazis by hand-digging tunnels from their occupied village into the woods, where there was a larger group of Jews living in holes to evade detection. One of the others was a young man named Yosel Berkowitz. Ray and Yosel were married, and Yosel took his wife's last name because she came from a higher status family than he did.
How very modern.
Yes, Jared Kushner's grandpa, the original feminist. After Soviet troops liberated their village, Ray and Yosel lived in a refugee camp while they waited to find out if any countries would let them in.
Writing for ProPublica, Alan Sloan dug up an interesting excerpt from an interview Ray Kushner gave in 1982, where she recalled how miserable the ordeal was for her family. Quote, "The day after we got married in Budapest, Hungary, we smuggled ourselves over the border into Italy," Ray Kushner said. "This was our honeymoon. In Italy, we sat in a displaced persons camp. It was like being in the ghetto again. Nobody wanted to take us in. So for 3.5 years, we waited until we finally got a visa to come to the United States."
Yeah, the Kushners were ultimately able to leave the camp after Yosel, who had by then changed his name to Joshua, fudged his immigration forms a bit and claimed that his father was already living in the U.S. It was actually his father-in-law.
Can't begrudge people doing what they need in order to survive. But imagine how willfully unsympathetic Jared Kushner would have to be to fail to see the connection between the ways his own family was harmed by restrictive immigration policies and the ways that the Trump administration is doing the same thing to families now.
Yeah, what the Kushners did to get into this country would be, by MAGA standards, grounds for incarceration at a migrant detention center. Mm-hmm. So the Kushners moved to the U.S. and settled in New Jersey. They had three kids, Murray, Esther, and Charles. Joseph got into real estate and became part of what's known as the Holocaust Builders, European Jews who settled in the same part of Jersey around the same time and worked in the same business. The Holocaust Builders were typically people who kept their heads down and their minds on their businesses and their families. They weren't flashy or fame-seeking, and they certainly didn't want to draw too much attention by getting mixed up in politics.
But Charles Kushner was not like that. He was flashy, pushy, and ambitious, and was seen as gauche by others in their small community. In other words, he was kind of a dick.
Charles Kushner wasn't, haha, put this character on a reality show, trashy. He was throw him in the basura, trashy, for reasons we'll get to in a minute. Charles and his wife, Cyril, had four children, Dara, Nicole, Joseph, and today's fucking guy, Jared Corey Kushner, born on January 10th, 1981.
Jared Corey, a name meant to be airbrushed on a t-shirt on the Wildwood boardwalk.
Yep, that name comes with a Trans Am and a Valtrax prescription. Jared was the older of the two Kushner boys and his father's favorite. According to Vicki Ward's book, Kushner, Inc., Charles Kushner thought of himself as a kind of Joseph Kennedy figure and thought that Jared would make a great JFK. I think of Charles Kushner more like the George Bluth and Jared more like the Buster.
Charles wasn't all that interested in priming his daughters for greatness. This from a man who was descended from a woman so badass that she dug a tunnel out of a Nazi-occupied village.
Sexism is so dumb.
Charles was a well-known philanthropist who gave to schools and hospitals, as well as synagogues and charitable causes, both stateside and in Israel.
He also donated to a lot of Democratic politicians. One was a young upstart named Cory Booker, who launched an ultimately failed mayoral campaign in 2002, a campaign partially fueled by a donation from Daddy Kushner. Charles had a tight relationship with Benjamin Netanyahu, the future Israeli prime minister, who would take Jared's childhood bed during one of his visits with the family, displacing Jared to the basement for the night.
That is bananas.
That's bananas.
It's bananas. But Charles Kushner's prized political pet was a man named Jim McGreevy, who ascended all the way from mayor of Woodbridge Township to the New Jersey governor's mansion before his career and life came crashing down. His rise and spectacular fall would not have been possible without Charles Kushner.
In the few years between when Kushner and McGreevy met in the late 1990s and when both men's lives went tits up, Kushner and his close associates donated at least $369,000 to McGreevy. Kushner was also what's known as a bundler, which is a donor who wrangles up donations from other donors. Reporting suggests that Kushner raised at least $1 million for McGreevy when he successfully ran for governor of New Jersey in 2001.
In 2002, McGreevy nominated Kushner to be the chairman of the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey. This was a powerful post that would have given Charles Kushner sway over the redevelopment of the World Trade Center site, as well as influence over billions in trade.
Now, even for the corrupt world of New Jersey politics, this was a bridge and tunnel too far. As Charles was cozying up to McGreevy, trouble was brewing in the Kushner clan. The first generation of American Kushners were at one point a close-knit extended family. According to a New York Magazine piece from the early aughts, Esther, Murray, and Charles would take big extended family trips together. All the kids, all the grandkids, etc. But that all started to come apart when, in 2001, Murray sued Charles over allegations that Charles had cheated Murray out of money from real estate deals. Murray's suit also alleged that Charles had been mismanaging funds in other ways, funneling millions to political candidates and public figures like Benjamin Netanyahu, to whom Charles had allegedly paid hundreds of thousands of dollars in speaking fees. Before discovery could be completed and evidence of Charles' dealings could be made public, the case was sealed.
Enter Robert Yontef. Yontef, a former Kushner Company employee, also sued Charles, alleging he was fired after he'd helped Murray's lawyers assemble documents necessary for the original suit to proceed.
So the Port Authority nomination happened while there were still all these unanswered questions about Kushner's business dealings. Charles Kushner had girl bossed too close to the sun.
Because the pieces were moving into place for McGreevy's downfall to happen almost in tandem with Kushner's. In 2000, Charles Kushner had taken McGreevy with him on one of his many trips to Israel. While they were there, according to Vicky Ward, Charles introduced McGreevy to a young man named Golan Sipple. After he was elected governor, McGreevy appointed Sipple to a Homeland Security post, which confused people because Golan Sipple had, like, no experience.
Now, that was back when people would actually get upset by know-nothing political appointees. Eyebrows were raised. Whispers were wisped. McGreevy was married and had children, but by 2003, rumors were swirling that Sipple was going to file a sexual harassment suit against the governor, which would include allegations that the governor and Sipple were in a same-sex relationship, which led to this Hall of Fame awkward press conference.
I engaged in an adult consensual affair with another man, which violates my bonds of matrimony. It was wrong, it was foolish, it was inexcusable. And for this, I ask the forgiveness and the grace of my wife. She has been extraordinary throughout this ordeal, and I am blessed by virtue of her love and strength. Given the circumstances surrounding the affair and its likely impact upon my family and my ability to govern, I have decided the right course of action is to resign.
Sometimes I'm worried that we haven't come very far, where I'm like, man, things are worse now for women than they were in the 90s. And then I see footage like this and I'm like, I feel like today it would be more acceptable for a wife to be like, fuck you, though. Like, I'm not standing behind you.
One rumor recounted by New York Magazine was that it was Kushner who had egged Sipple's lawsuit on because Kushner knew he was about to go down and wanted to take McGreevy with him.
After McGreevy's resignation, state lawmakers demanded that Kushner submit to a review of his business practices before they'd confirm him to one of the most powerful appointments in the state. But rather than be scrutinized, Charles Kushner withdrew his nomination.
This did not help dispel suspicions that Charles Kushner was hiding some dirty dealings. Investigators started sniffing around.
And that's when Charles Kushner really broke bad. He suspected that his sister Esther Shoulder and her husband Bill were helping the feds in their investigation into Kushner's dealings. And so to get back at her, he paid a prostitute $10,000 to lure Bill to a hotel, seduce him, and secretly record the sexual encounter. Kushner then mailed the tape of the blowjob to Bill's wife, again his own sister, and timed it to arrive on the same day as her son's engagement party.
I keep it classy.
So anybody who's looked into Jared Kushner's piece of shit dad knows about that. But I was surprised to learn in researching this that Charles Kushner tried the same scheme with a different guy Robert Yontef, the guy who had helped with Murray's lawsuit. Yontef rejected the prostitute's advances, though.
In 2004, an ambitious federal prosecutor by the name of Chris Christie secured an 18-count indictment against Daddy Kushner. The charges included illegal campaign contributions, tax crimes, and witness retaliation.
Yeah, the witness retaliation charge came courtesy of Kushner's sister Esther, who had taken her husband's blowjob tape directly to the feds.
What a messy bunch.
Kushner surrendered willingly and pled guilty. Why? Well, there's a lot of speculation about this. One school of thought is that Christie's investigation had been so aggressive that Kushner's team just wanted him to lay off before he uncovered other stuff. Vicki Ward reported in Kushner, Inc. that the unsubstantiated rumor that Christie had threatened to expose Kushner for being secretly bisexual or other salacious details of his personal life.
There's never been any verified evidence confirming this rumor, but the fact that it exists and is written down in a book is a testament to what an attack dog Christie was and how eager he was to bring Charles Kushner down.
Gotta respect it, right?
Respect.
Let's get back to Jared for a second. Growing up, the future golden boy of the Trump White House was, by all accounts, about as unremarkable as a white gym sock. He attended private Jewish schools where he was a mediocre student. He played high school basketball and was a big fan of Billy Joel.
That's Seton Hall caliber, not Ivy League.
But shortly before it was time for Jared to apply to college, Charles made a $2.5 million donation to Harvard University. And then, lo and behold, his favorite son got in.
What do you
Jared
know?
Jared got in over the actual exceptional students at his high school that had better grades than him.
Mediocrity at work.
The line is actually meritocracy, but mediocrity, I
whatever,
think, is a
both.
Great. Hey, let's keep the portmanteau. I love it. Mediocracy. By most accounts, Jared was also boring and average at Harvard, returning home most weekends and spending his free time buying and selling real estate in the greater Boston area. After graduating, he enrolled at NYU in a dual MBA and JD program.
Wow, so he must have done okay at Harvard.
I mean, hard to say. He was enrolled in the NYU program in 2003, which happened to be the same year that Charles Kushner rented some prime office space to NYU at a discounted rate. And he'd also made a donation to NYU in the recent past.
Weird.
Charles Kushner went to prison in 2005. And when his dad was in the clink, Jared would visit him regularly. He maintains to this day that his father was not a corrupt piece of trash, but rather a victim of prosecutorial excess, even though in his 2022 book, Breaking History, he admitted that his dad made some big, big mistakes. Jared hasn't said much about the actual academic aspects of his college years. After college, he used the money he earned from collegiate junior slumlording to purchase the New York Observer, a once venerable journalistic outfit that he would go on to slowly ruin. He hired former Gawker editor Elizabeth Spears to sit atop the masthead. Spears has recounted both on social media and in a lengthy op-ed for the Washington Post that Jared was kind of an idiot who didn't know what he was doing.
Spears observed his business acumen thusly, quote, "Yes, he ran the company, which he inherited, not uncommon in New York's dynastic insular real estate world, but he was sure he had the goods. When I worked for him, I didn't think he had a realistic view of his own capabilities since, like his father-in-law, he seemed to view his wealth and its concomitant accoutrements as rewards for his personal success in business, and not something he would have had in any case. To me, he appeared to view his position and net worth as the products of an essentially meritocratic process."
I've also heard through secondhand sources that Jared is, quote, dumb and mean. Somebody I know who worked for The Observer during these years after the Spears era said that they never saw Jared in the office. Not once. Mm. It's pretty much consensus among media watchers that Jared destroyed the New York Observer. Mm-hmm. But quality journalism that New Yorkers can depend on was never what he aimed to do. Some have implied that the real reason Jared bought The Observer is so that there'd be a place for him to launder his family's flagging reputation.
Charles Kushner got out of jail in 2006 after serving 14 months of his two-year sentence and served out the remainder of his term in a halfway house. After that, he wasn't supposed to be taking an active role in running the company, but it was widely acknowledged that Charles was the puppet master, even though Jared technically had the title of head of his dad's company.
I mean, Bluth family vibes. 2007 was a big year for bumpet hairstyles, Forever 21 going out tops, and Jared Kushner. For one thing, this was the year he was introduced to his future wife, Ivanka Trump.
Charles and Sarah Kushner had some issues with her at first because she wasn't Jewish. For a time, the two broke up, but they got back together.
According to Vicki Ward, Donald Trump was also initially disappointed with Jared before coming around to him. He'd hoped to marry his prize child off to New England Patriots quarterback Tom Brady. I seriously think it sounds like something like a six-year-old would do.
It's
like,
crazy.
But both sets of parents eventually came around to the coupling. After all, both families were Manhattan outsiders who desperately wanted the adoration and fear of the insiders who looked down on them. Ivanka converted to Judaism, and in 2009, Jovanka got married in a 500-person over-the-top ceremony at Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey. Alyssa, I wonder if mother of the bride, Ivana Trump, knew that within a decade, she'd be buried on that very golf course.
I knew that's where you were going. Ivanka wore a Vera Wang gown meant to pay homage to Grace Kelly, who she's weirdly obsessed with. She tried to do Grace Kelly cosplay at her sister Tiffany's wedding years later, America's Princess Girl Boss.
Yes, Jared and Ivanka, like their parents, are also weirdly obsessed with the Kennedys. Now, I know you and I have talked about this, but you know, all three of Ivanka and Jared's kids have Kennedy names.
Yes.
Joseph, Theodore, and Arabella. Now, who is Arabella? Arabella is the name of JFK and Jackie's first daughter, who died shortly after she was born.
Jackie-O? More like Tacky-O.
So that's the fairy tale origin of the Jovankan romance. But back to banner year 2007. That's when Jared demonstrated his impeccable market timing by purchasing 666 Fifth Avenue. I went down a rabbit hole researching this episode, and yes, it turns out that a powerful Orthodox Jew with ties to Israel purchasing a building with the address 666 was not handled calmly by America's anti-Semitic lunatic fringe. There are theories that the Kushners are part of a secretive sect that worships the ancient Canaanite god Baal.
Whoa.
Yeah, Baal is huge in the lunatic fringe right now, Alyssa. So much Baal. I saw more than a few message board dwellers suggesting that Jared is the Antichrist, which is so silly on its face because the Antichrist would have more gravitas than a guy who sounds like this when he talks.
My name is Jared Kushner. I am senior advisor to President Donald J. Trump. When my father-in-law decided to run for president, I served his campaign the best I could because I believe in him and his ability to improve the lives of all Americans. And now, serving the president and the people of the United States has been the honor and privilege of a lifetime.
You know what I mean? Like, the Antichrist is going to be like, he's going to have like a James Earl Jones thing.
100%.
He's got to have Riz.
Jared Kushner is associated with real stupid and real evil stuff. No need to involve the old gods here.
When Jared tried to make his felon dad's skyscraper wishes come true by purchasing a building with an unfortunate address, real estate had been going up, up, up. Number not go down. Not ever. And so Kushner Companies, led at least on paper by Jared, aggressively pursued the eye-popping $1.8 billion purchase of 666 Fifth Avenue. At the time, it was the biggest transaction in the history of Manhattan commercial real estate.
Yes, it was. Shortly thereafter, the 2008 financial crisis would hit and, uh-oh, number go down.
Uh-oh. In the ensuing years, that's how I imagine business school.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Where's number? Number fall down. In the ensuing years, 666 Fifth Ave would become considered one of the worst real estate deals in all of Manhattan.
What a business savant. I can't believe that anybody would suggest that Jared didn't deserve to get into Harvard.
In the years before Jared's father-in-law would slither down the golden escalator and embed himself into our nightmares forever, Jared Kushner was focused primarily on his family's real estate portfolio, which consisted mainly of what people might refer to as downmarket apartment rentals that are frequently the subject of complaints. Yeah, the Kushners are slumlords.
That's a loaded term.
I've got some reasons to back this
up. Okay.
It's based on a long rap sheet of alleged slimy behaviors, like the tenants of 18 Sydney Place in Brooklyn Heights, who sued Kushner Companies for illegally charging market rate rent on apartments that should have been rent stabilized. Between 2013 and 2016, Kushner Companies allegedly filed false paperwork claiming that buildings they owned didn't contain rent stabilized tenants. They did this 80 different times across 34 different buildings.
Why would they do that?
To dodge city oversight for renovations. They also allegedly would try to use noisy and disruptive construction work as a way to force tenants out. Funny story, when I was in NYC, I dated a guy whose building was bought by a Kushner company. Mm-hmm. And basically right away, the long-term super was kicked out for renovations that were incredibly loud and seemed unsafe.
I remember hearing about this one. Kushner Village in the East Village was subject to a lawsuit alleging unsafe conditions, like non-working fire sprinklers, neglected repairs, and generally unlivable conditions. Residents at one point wanted to withhold rent because their apartments were so crappy.
Best city in the world, New York. In 2018, the Kushner Company was fined $210,000 for filing false paperwork while Jared was in charge. They'd claimed that buildings were empty in order to obtain construction permits, when in fact they're full of tenants, some of which are rent controlled. They did that over and over again.
Seems like a favorite trick of theirs.
Yeah, so that's why I call them slumlords.
Fair enough.
Okay, let's skip ahead a bit to the election of Donald Trump in 2016. I know, we don't want to go there, but we've got to. Once Trump was elected, Jared immediately joined the transition team. The transition team was chaired by none other than Chris Christie, the former prosecutor who had thrown Jared's dad in prison a little more than a decade prior. Now, Jared had a problem with this. According to an interview Chris Christie gave to the Fifth Column podcast, Lil Kushner immediately whined about the appointment to Trump and kept whining about it until Christie was fired.
Revenge is his.
Yeah, it's like an anticlimactic version of The Sopranos where instead of killing Christopher, Tony complains about him to HR. It's always kind of seemed like Donald Trump talked about Jared Kushner like he wanted to fuck his daughter vicariously through him.
So gross.
I know, but it's true. But during his first term in office, it became clear that Donald Trump also doesn't know anybody smarter than Jared Kushner. When Trump was inaugurated in 2017, Jared was named senior advisor and granted an interim top secret sensitive compartmented information, or SCI, clearance.
Right. An interim clearance isn't weird by itself. Lots of senior officials of incoming administrations get temporary clearance while the process unfolds. Here's where it gets weird. He had initially submitted his background paperwork in 2016, but in 2017, he submitted at least three revisions that stated that actually he'd omitted extensive details of meetings with foreign officials, including Russian nationals. Team Kushner had said that the omissions weren't on purpose and that he'd corrected them once he discovered the errors. Still, his full clearance wasn't granted until 2018. And you know, I have some experience with these matters.
The agent brought in my form and soon she asked how many times had I smoked pot. I said, I didn't know. More than 20? Yes, I replied, more than 20. More than 100? Yes, I said more than 100. More than 500? Just right, unknown. They were finally satisfied with more than 500 would be fair. Because she told the truth, because she didn't lie about the 500 plus times she had smoked pot, Alistair Mastromonaco did get her security clearance.
Tell the truth. Just have to tell the truth.
Hysteria is brought to you by Babbel. Why do most of us want to learn a new language? It's probably not about memorizing grammar tables or topping a leaderboard. It's because we want to speak it out in the real world with real people. Babbel gets you there fast. If you're traveling this summer, here's a real travel hack. Don't wait until you land to start learning the language. Instead, try Babbel. I learned that the hard way when I flew into Chile and was like, oh, wait, I can't speak Spanish and most people here cannot speak English. Even just 10 minutes a day with Babbel can help you start to have real conversations in as little as 3 weeks. Instead of memorizing random vocab, you're learning phrases you'd use ordering dinner, asking for directions, or talking with locals. What I like about Babbel is it's built for real life. No vocab lists, no verb charts, but real conversation practice. Lessons are quick, practical, and built by more than 200 language experts. They have interactive dialogue, personalized reviews, even podcasts, all designed to get you speaking quickly and confidently. And unlike cramming before a trip, Babbel fits into your actual schedule, coffee break, commute, or a few minutes before bed. Babbel's award-winning app has sold over 25 million subscriptions and is backed by a 14-day money-back guarantee. I've mentioned on this pod that we're sending my four-year-old to a dual language program either this year or next year. And I'm going to have to learn how to talk to her so that she can't talk crap about me behind my back. If you got summer travel coming up, now's the time to start so you can actually use what you learn on the trip. Right now, Babbel is offering listeners up to 60% off. Go to babbel.com/hysteria. That's Babbel, Babbel.com/hysteria for up to 60% off. Rules and restrictions may apply. Hysteria is brought to you by Shopify. Starting something new isn't just hard. It can be scary. So much work goes into an idea that you're not entirely sure will work out, and it can be hard to make that leap of faith, but it helps when you have a partner like Shopify on your side. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like Allbirds and Momofuku to brands just getting started. Accelerate your efficiency, whether you're uploading new products or trying to improve existing ones. Shopify is packed with helpful AI tools that write product descriptions, page headlines, and even enhance your product photography. Get the word out like you have a marketing team behind you. Easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. Tackle all those important tasks in one place, from inventory to payments to analytics and more. No need to save multiple websites or try to figure out what platform is hosting the tool that you need. Everything is all in one place, making your life easier and your business operations smoother. It's time to turn those what-ifs into with Shopify today. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/hysteria. Go to shopify.com/hysteria. That's shopify.com/hysteria. Jared's disclosure slipperiness didn't stop him from being given a Barbie-adjacent number of jobs, but he's just Ken.
He is pretty Ken-like.
I don't think he has genitals, Alyssa. Under Jared's pants, the outline of molded plastic underwear, and him and Ivanka kiss by mashing their faces together.
I believe that.
Yeah, Jared's most daunting job was being put in charge of the Middle Eastern peace process. Now, this raised some alarm bells.
Not disclosing foreign contacts. He had no experience in diplomacy, hadn't even been to most of the countries that he was supposed to be dealing with. Although he had gone on a star-studded trip to Jordan once. Second, Benjamin Netanyahu was a family friend who stayed over Jared's house.
Yeah, that's a problem.
It's a problem.
Navigating the politics of the Middle East is a complicated job, requiring somebody with vast historical knowledge and the ability to manage conflicting sensitivities. Giving the job to Jared Kushner made about as much sense as choosing a heart surgeon based on how many hot dogs they can eat in under 5 minutes. But that didn't matter.
Nope.
Smartest guy President Trump knows. President Trump's leadership style is similar to the way a button-mashing three-year-old plays video games. He wildly flails around. Sometimes he randomly hits a button that does something good. And because the game is so often rigged in his favor, even when he mashes the wrong button, he's usually insulated from the consequences of his mistakes.
To be fair, the more we learn about how unremarkable the super rich are, the more it seems like a lot of them are just button-mashing through life and being lauded as geniuses by people who want their money.
I mean, Elon Musk,
right?
Peter Thiel, they're all button mashing.
Critics of Kushner's handling of Middle East peace, a hilarious collection of words to say in that order, pointed out that Jared frequently skipped over the State Department entirely in pursuing his goals, which broke protocol, but more importantly, is just an inefficient way to conduct yourself as a member of the executive branch.
Like trying to fix a broken bone with a little duct tape.
Mm-hmm.
Kushner enjoyed a cozy relationship with Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, or MBS, which got a bit awkward when, on October 2nd, 2018, the Saudi-American journalist Jamal Khashoggi entered the Saudi Arabian consulate in Istanbul and never left. Mm. Khashoggi was killed and dismembered with a bone saw by a 15-man goon squad, ostensibly in response to Khashoggi's vocal criticism of the Saudi government. Saudi Arabia has denied that MBS was directly involved, but both Turkish and American intelligence have independently concluded, to the point of near certainty, that the operation was carried out with the approval of MBS, if not at his direction.
Whenever Jared has been asked about this, he's given one of his trademark pageant answers. Of course, we don't like murder. It's very bad. Saudi Arabia is a strategic partner. MBS is a dude I work with on things. Money, please. Interviews with him sound like a shareholder call for a company that has had a bad quarter.
Yeah, so after all this toe-stepping and learning curving in the Middle East, Jared brokered a peace agreement called the Abraham Accords. But it's a stretch to call it a peace agreement when Israel had to make zero concessions to Palestinians. Palestinians weren't even initially involved. And critics say it actually resulted in more arms sales between countries, which made an already volatile region even more militarized. But great for Raytheon shareholders, I guess.
But don't just trust us. We're professional haters. Let's see what the people who study this day in and day out have to say. Writing for Rush University's Baker Institute for Public Policy, Middle East policy expert Omar Rahman said the agreement, one, lacks intrinsic value, two, is over-reliant on the U.S., three, produces too much risk for Gulf states, four, is tremendously unpopular in the Middle East, and five, is facing the headwinds of a changing regional context.
Okay. Still, the Accords take up a huge portion of Jared Kushner's Wikipedia page like it's the Harvard diploma his dad bought him. President Trump put Jared in charge of something called the Office of American Innovation. It was a job made up just for Jared.
I've never heard of it.
In theory, it was supposed to increase government efficiency and eliminate waste. In practice, the OAI kind of functioned like a middle manager, eager to take credit for processes that had already been underway when they took them on as projects.
One function of OAI was supposed to be streamlining government agencies and cutting down on overlap, functions that were not performed at all by OAI and would go on to be performed with great clumsiness by the poorly behaved children of DOGE 8 years later.
Steve Bannon once told me that he thinks Jared Kushner is dumb as a stick.
Broken clock.
Jared was also put in charge of immigration reform because why not? He set out to find a path forward in a divided country for funding border security, how to handle ongoing protections for DACA recipients, and reforms to the visa process. He tried to accomplish all of these goals at once. Therefore, he accomplished none of these goals.
This might have been because he didn't involve actual key players in the immigration picture. He cut out career DHS officials, advocacy groups, actual experts, and Congress.
Seeing a pattern here. Jared's biggest White House faceplant was in helping handle the federal government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. First, like just about everybody in the administration, while he paid lip service to readiness and deference to experts, reality didn't bear his posturing out. This interview with Bloomberg that he did in January 2020 makes me feel a little sick to my stomach to watch today.
How's the administration monitoring coronavirus? This is something that's on the minds of a lot of Americans.
The answer is very closely. President Trump's been getting briefed regularly. Mm-hmm. In the U.S. government, we have so many tremendous resources and incredible people, and the president's been meeting with them constantly. He's reached out to China to offer any support they may need. They're being very transparent so far, we believe, in terms of the information they've been sharing with us. And the hope is that we'll continue to work the problem, and hopefully it will get under control.
Confidence inspiring.
Ugh.
By mid-March 2020, when life was shutting down and the pandemic was spiraling out of control, Jared was put in charge of supply chain logistics for things like PPE and ventilators. On March 19th, he was front and center at a press conference about the Trump administration's response to supply shortages.
You have instances where in cities they're running out, but the state still has a stockpile. And the notion of the federal stockpile was it's supposed to be our stockpile. It's not supposed to be state stockpiles that they then use. So we're encouraging the states to make sure that they're assessing the needs, they're getting the data from their local situations, and then trying to fill it with the supplies that we've given them. The same thing with the masks. What the president and the vice president were able to do with Congress was to get the waiver so that you could expand the pool, because a lot of the masks were used to defer the construction industry. So now there's a much bigger pool of masks in the country. There was a stockpile. They distributed that based on where they anticipated a lot of the need would go. But a lot of that still is stuck with the states, and it hasn't trickled down to the right places within the state. So I would just encourage you, when you have governors saying that the federal government hasn't given them what they need, I would just urge you to ask them, well, have you looked within your state?
What is the federal stockpile for, if not for U.S. citizens?
And also so many words.
Word salad.
Nothing. But behind the scenes, Jared was screwing the pandemic pooch. According to a report in Vanity Fair by Catherine Ebon, during those early days of the pandemic, private sector business leaders were eager for direction on how to redirect their industrial output toward providing essential medical supplies. But they needed President Trump to invoke the Defense Production Act in order for the plan to work. That plan ran into a Jared Kushner-shaped pothole. I'm going to read from Ebon's reporting of how one particularly crazy Kushner-led meeting went. Quote, Kushner, seated at the head of the conference table, in a chair taller than all the others, was quick to strike a confrontational tone. The federal government is not going to lead this response, he announced. It's up to the states to figure out what they want to do. One attendee explained to Kushner that due to the finite supply of PPE, Americans were bidding against each other and driving prices up. To solve that, businesses eager to help were looking to the federal government for leadership and direction. Free markets will solve this, Kushner said dismissively. That is not the role of government. The same attendee explained that although he believed in open markets, he feared that the system was breaking. As evidence, he pointed to a CNN report about New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and his desperate call for supplies. That's a CNN bullshit, Kushner snapped. They lie. According to another attendee, Kushner then began to rail against the governor. Cuomo didn't pound the phones hard enough to get PPE for his state. His people are going to have to suffer, and that's their problem. End quote. So, essentially, Jared Kushner used his role at the center of the federal government's COVID-19 response to be like, hey, we're not going to do anything to help. That's for the states. Kafkaesque corporate nonsense.
Ebon reported that later that summer, Jared, quote, had commissioned a robust federal COVID-19 testing plan only to abandon it before it could be implemented. Why would anyone do that?
For the most gross and evil reason imaginable. Politics. 2020 was an election year. Some in the White House believed that the virus was hitting Democratic states and cities the hardest, and that when federal government allowed those states to twist in the wind, Republicans could blame Democratic elected officials. Yuck.
Okay.
Iban called Kushner's approach to COVID the consultant state as opposed to the deep state, which I think is brilliant. That description paints a picture of a bunch of useless McKenzie types circling back around and putting a pin in it and ideating on deliverables, which makes Kushner's waxy grimacing through COVID seem even more sinister.
I think you'll see by June, a lot of the country should be back to normal. And the hope is that by July, the country's really rocking again. Federal government rose to the challenge, and this is a great success story. And I think that that's really, you know, what needs to be told.
Rocking. Whenever you get mad about how 2020 screwed our lives up, remember, it was kind of, a little bit, Jared Kushner's fault. Kind of. Informally, Jared was also a White House communication coordinator, which is code for sticking his nose into everything and mucking up the gears.
Kushner is one of those business boys who doesn't know anything about the world and surmises with a bunch of MBA brainiacs that, hey, maybe it is time to reinvent the wheel, you know? Now let's check back in with the Kushner family business. Remember 666 Fifth Avenue?
Of course.
Well, yeah, the family was growing increasingly desperate to restructure the debt on that building because it was such a terrible investment that it could have taken the whole company down with it.
Luckily, and I'm sure completely coincidentally, during the first couple of years of Trump 1.0, what do you know? Kushner Companies secured a Freddie Mac-backed refinancing deal with incredibly favorable terms. For 10 years, they would only need to pay the interest on the $786 million loan, which covered servicing of 666 Fifth Avenue in addition to other properties in the Kushner portfolio.
In 2018, the property was sold to a few different entities, and the Kushner family's original investment was basically wiped out. Now, there's no smoking gun here to prove that Jared Kushner's sister, Nicole Kushner Meyer, invoked her brother's name at any stage in the negotiating process with Freddie Mac, or that Jared himself was directly involved in lining up financing or buyers. But the appearance of impropriety when the family business of a high-level government official secures a ridiculously favorable loan backed by the government, that doesn't look great.
This showcased how susceptible Jared was to influence from foreigners because his family business needed access to capital. Foreign entities could offer that capital. Why wouldn't they ask for a little something extra? Favorable treatment by a high-ranking member of the administration, perhaps?
Perhaps. By the end of Trump 1.0, Jared Kushner was trudging along with the burden of his duties and scrutiny like Florence Pugh at the end of Midsummer. And he was tired of all the attention. You won't have Jared Corey Kushner to kick around anymore, America. Soon after departing the White House, his brand new private equity firm, Affinity Partners, nabbed a $2 billion investment from a Saudi fund. The face of the other side of this deal was none other than his not murderer, but not a murderer, not a friend, but not a friend, Mohammed bin Salman.
Bonesaw boy. Allegedly.
Yep. And according to Andrea Bernstein in The Atlantic, MBS invested in Jared's business against the advice of his own advisors. This was mainly because Jared's firm was unsatisfactory in all aspects, according to their analysis.
Makes sense. Jared and his partners had barely any experience in private equity before starting his post-Trump fund.
Yeah, but MBS wanted to invest because they wanted to maintain a friendship with Kushner.
Well. What were we saying about susceptibility to foreign influence?
Apparently, Jared's Mark status is the worst kept secret in international relations.
In interviews during the Biden years, Jared swore off participating in politics as he scurried around the world collecting money from shady foreigners like a squirrel on a nut farm. But the siren's call of political involvement drew him back in.
Jared Kushner is now Schrodinger's secretary. He is a government official when he needs access to state secrets and foreign leaders, but he's not a government official when he wants to use that access to make money. Bernstein writes, without title or remit or any kind of official designation, only presidential son-in-law, Kushner has in the first 14 months of the second Trump administration sat down with world leaders, including Vladimir Putin, Benjamin Netanyahu, and Volodymyr Zelensky, along with Saudis and multiple other actors from the Middle East.
That is bananas.
I know.
You don't need security clearance when you're not an official. He's getting all the access that comes with working for the government with none of the constraints. It's like meeting somebody's parents and then they still refuse to call you their girlfriend.
Except this is exactly what Jared wants. He's free of the pesky headline risk that came with working in the White House in an official capacity, and now he can do what he probably always wanted to do anyway, which is enrich himself by playing a game that has never been more rigged for him. He can cosplay as JFK and Joseph Kennedy at the same time. He's not a special government employee like Elon Musk was. Mm-hmm. He's not an employee at all, according to the White House. He's a volunteer. Alyssa, is that a thing?
I can confirm volunteer is not a real thing. Volunteer is not a real job in the White House. Look, whatever Jared is, he's doing some very sensitive shit. He went to Davos presenting a plan for the future of Gaza, but also while at Davos, he was soliciting cash for his private equity firm.
Jared has said some weird things about Gaza, like during this interview wherein he mused about the valuable waterfront property. It was the site of hundreds of thousands of mostly civilian deaths at the hands of the Israeli military.
There are real fears on the part of Arabs, and I'm sure you talk to a lot of them, who think once Gazans leave Gaza, Netanyahu's never going to let them back in.
Maybe, but I'm not sure there's much left of Gaza at this point. So, you know, if you think about even the construct, like, you know, Gaza was not really a historical precedent, right? It was the result of a war, right? You had tribes that were in different places, but then Gaza became a thing. Egypt, you know, used to run it. And then, you know, over time, you had different governments that came in different ways. How do we deal with the terror threat that is there so that it cannot be a threat to Israel or to Egypt, right? I think that both sides are spending a fortune on military. I think neither side really wants to have, you know, a terrorist organization enclaved right between them. And Gaza's waterfront property, it could be very valuable to if people would focus on kind of building up you know, livelihoods. You think about all the money that's gone into this tunnel network and into all the munitions. If that would have gone into education or innovation, what could have been done? And so I think that it's a little bit of an unfortunate situation there. But I think from Israel's perspective, I would do my best to move the people out and then clean it up. But I don't think that Israel has stated that they don't want the people to move back there afterwards.
Waterfront.
What a
everything we always knew.
Thing. I like, oh my God, jaw on the floor. Now, does Jared Kushner's family stand to benefit financially from other unrest in Israel? Also, yes, according to analysis from Jacobin magazine. The Trump administration recently lifted sanctions against settlers in the occupied West Bank in East Jerusalem. These settlers are responsible for at least 1,000 attacks on Palestinians in the last year. Just before the Israeli ceasefire was announced, Kushner's private equity firm received regulators' approval to double its stake in Phoenix Financial Limited, an Israeli insurance behemoth that, among other things, finances and insures construction of settlers' homes and businesses in Palestinian territory. Jared has said the investment has already returned ninefold. Mm. Congrats, dude, I guess. I don't know.
Way to go. By the end of 2024, Kushner's private equity enterprise was 99% funded by foreign money. In the run-up to the 2024 presidential election, a Senate committee looked into Kushner's business and discovered that they'd been paid $157 million in management fees by foreign clients, and they hadn't paid anything out.
Why would somebody invest in something that doesn't pay out unless they're getting something besides money from the arrangement?
Ethics disclosures? We don't need no stinking ethics disclosures.
Here's Jared bullshitting his way through an explanation about why it's okay for him to be jetting around the world acting like a government official by traveling on government planes with Special Envoy Steve Witkoff.
What people call conflicts of interest, Steve and I call experience and trusted relationships that we have throughout the world. If Steve and I didn't have these deep relationships, the deal that we were able to help get done that freed these hostages would not have occurred.
Worst episode of couples therapy ever.
Truly.
Through all this, Jared found time in 2022 to write a book. New York Times book reviewer Dwight Garner described Kushner's breaking history as lengthy and soulless. Garner wrote, Kushner looks like a mannequin and he writes like one. And now I'm going to read an excerpt from this review because, Alyssa, as you know, bitchy takedowns are my favorite genre of literary and food criticism. Just beautiful. This is great. This book is like a tour of a once majestic 18th century wooden house now burned to its foundations that focuses solely on and rejoices in what's left amid the ashes. The two singed bathtubs, the gravel driveway, and the mailbox. Kushner's fealty to Trump remains absolute. Reading this book reminded me of watching a cat lick a dog's eye glue. The tone is college admissions essay. Typical sentence. In an environment of maximum pressure, I learned to ignore the noise and distractions and instead to push for results that would improve lives. Every political cliche gets a fresh shampooing. Quote, even in a starkly divided country, there are always opportunities to build bridges, Kushner writes. And quoting the former White House Deputy Chief of Staff, Chris Liddell, every day here is sand through an hourglass and we have to make it count. So true, for these are the days of our lives, end quote.
Yum. Delish.
It's so good. It's so good. You have to read the whole review.
In 2026, Forbes estimated that Kushner has joined the ranks of American billionaires. That's up from 900 million in 2025.
And he did it all on his own.
Yup. Nobody helped him at all. All on merit. Like his Harvard and NYU admissions and that job in the White House and that loan his family business got when he was working for the White House and the $2 billion the Saudis gave his fledgling fund. All hard work, all grit.
Now, he's not the first Kushner to hit a billion, though. That distinction belongs to both his dad and his father's second favorite son, Josh Kushner, founder of Oscar Health and husband of supermodel Karlie Kloss, otherwise known as the less terrible Kushner. He was photographed at the Women's March in 2017, which is slightly more than the least he could possibly
I stood
do.
Next to him.
That is so wild.
I know, it's so weird.
Okay, and what became of Charles Kushner, the felonious patriarch? Well, everything turned out just fine for him. In one of his last acts before leaving office the first time, President Trump gave Daddy Kushner a full pardon. Chris Christie has suggested that the only reason that Jared joined the administration in the first place was so that he could make that happen. And after Trump was inaugurated a second time, Charles Kushner, who had once hired a prostitute to seduce his own brother-in-law in order to get revenge on his sister, was nominated to be ambassador to France. One Democrat voted to approve the appointment. New Jersey's Cory Booker, a long-ago recipient of some of that sweet, sweet Kushner political donation money. So, there you have it, folks. Jared Cory Kushner, the silver spoon, slope-shouldered, favored son of a crook who has been handed everything and earned nothing, except, of course, our collective derision. Grandma Ray, the one-time refugee who lived in a hole to escape the Nazis, is shaking a rolling pin at these clowns from the afterlife.
Yes, she is.
Alyssa, where does Jared lie on our matrix of fucking guys?
All right, so we'll go with scheming sociopath and opportunist, right? He doesn't believe in anything, does he, other than money?
Yeah, I think that he is an opportunist and a little bit of a dumbass. But if you're really, really rich, like the opportunities you get just like keep coming and you keep thinking that you like made them happen.
Oh, he really does think he made it all happen.
That about wraps up the time we have for this episode of This Fucking Guy. If you like what you've seen, hit the like button, share with your friends, and leave us a comment if you've got an idea for a future fucking guy subject. Mm-hmm. This episode was written and researched by me, Erin Ryan, with an assist from Alyssa Mastromonaco. Caroline Reston is Hysteria's senior producer. All of the rest of our credits, as well as links to our sources, like Andrea Bernstein's work in The Atlantic and Craig Horowitz's banger of a piece on Jim McGreevy from New York Magazine, can be found in our show notes. Trust me, guys, the bibliography is always a fun read. Take care. Be well. Don't hire an MBA to do a diplomat's job. And fuck that guy. Fuck that guy.
Fuck that guy.
Hysteria is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Caroline Reston, Claire Fogarty, Kendra James, Adrian Hill, Alyssa Mastromonaco, and me, Erin Ryan. Our team includes Matt DeGroat, Rachel Gajewski, Delon Villanueva, Claudia Sheng, Mia Kelman, Jay Banks, Charlotte Landis, and Jordan Cantor. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
In moments like these, it's easy to feel overwhelmed and even easier to feel powerless. But we are neither. I'm Stacey Abrams, and on my podcast, Assembly Required, I take on each executive action, legislative battle, and breaking news moment by asking three questions. What's really happening? What can we do about it? And how do we keep going together? This is a space for clarity, strategy, and hope rooted in action. Not denial. New episodes of Assembly Required drop Tuesdays. Tune in wherever you get your podcasts and on YouTube.